Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now, I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word.
So it's my pleasure to be joined on the G word today for the first time with a small group. So we're innovating in our format from a one-to-one conversation to a discussion as a group. And I've got a fantastic group of expert practitioners with me today who are going to explain how the work on using genomics to understand the severity of human response to the coronavirus, to COVID-19, has been taking place. And we'll dig under the hood a bit on that. So just over a year ago, as everyone was trying to figure out what was going on with COVID, one of the real puzzles was why some people responded so severely to the virus that either they sadly died or were in intensive care or on a ventilator, whereas others who might be the same age, from the same background, with the same kind of health, would respond in such a different way, either in a very mild way or even completely asymptomatic. And in order to try to unpick that puzzle, we at Genomics England partnered with a group from the University of Edinburgh called Genomic, the Genomics of Mortality in Critical Care, to try to understand what in our DNA, in our genome, could help to explain this difference in response. And so to do that, we recruited a whole group of people from intensive care units who had COVID very, very severely. We also had a call for volunteers who had only a mild or asymptomatic response to COVID, and we were able to combine the data sets that we could generate from those participants with the amazing asset that we already have at Genomics England of the 100,000 Genomes Project in order to compare what was happening in their DNA and to start to unpick that puzzle. And so we're going to hear from the team in a second about how that research work was done. Before we do that, I do want to just re-emphasize our thanks both to the original 100,000 Genomes Project participants and also to those who volunteered either through the intensive care units or through other channels. The fact that you and your families were willing to step forward in these incredibly trying times to help with this research has really enabled the whole thing and has been hugely impactful. So I do want to underline our thanks for them. The first findings from that report were published in Nature only a few months after that research program was launched, which is an extraordinarily rapid turnaround. And we're going to hear today about how that happened. And we'll also hear about some of the impact that those findings have had. That work is continuing, and we're now at the exciting stage of being able to put together a much larger group and the results from that. But before we dive into too many of the details of that, let's hear from the team themselves. So first, I'd love to introduce Erola, who's a member of the genomic team at the University of Edinburgh. Erola, say hi. Tell us about yourself.
Hi. So my name is Erola. I'm a postdoc in Kenneth Bailey's group in the University of Edinburgh. And I'm now working in genomic, which is focused on the study of the genetics of severe COVID-19.
Fantastic. And next up is Dorota from Genomics England.
Hi, hello, I'm Dorota. I'm the pharma analyst in Genomics England. However, by the time when we were involved in the initial research with the Genomic Consortium, I was actually analyzing data because I am bioinformatician by background. And at this point, I was helping out with the collaboration with Genomic.
Thanks. And then Susie from Genomics England.
Hi, I'm Susie. I'm a scientific delivery manager at Genomics England, and I've been a lifelong geneticist with interests in genomics and genomic technologies. And I'm working with the COVID analysis team to help interpret data and coordinate with the COVID-19 program as a whole.
Super. And finally, Athanasios from Genomics England.
Hello, I'm Athanasios, and I'm a genomic data scientist in Genomics England. And I'm currently working running analysis as part of the genomic and COVID project.
Fantastic. You lot as a group have really been at the heart of the research efforts on top of these data sets that we've been able to generate with the help of all of the volunteers and participants. Erola, I wonder if we could start with you. As we mentioned, only a few months after the beginning of this work, the first paper was published in Nature. Can you give us a sense of the findings from that paper for which you were the lead author? What did we discover and what does that mean?
So as you said, genomics studies the genetics of critical care. And since the beginning of the pandemic, we started recruiting individuals with severe COVID-19 from 208 ICUs across the UK. Then what we did is we compared the genome of these people with the genome of the general population. At the time of the paper, we had around 2,400 individuals with critical COVID-19. We found 8 regions of the genome that were related to severe COVID-19. From them, we could replicate 5 of them using independent studies. We looked at the genes nearby these regions, and they can be divided into 2 different groups of genes. Some genes are related to the host antiviral mechanisms, so how your body responds to a virus when it is presented. And the second part are mediators of inflammatory organ damage. So when people are in ICU for COVID-19, it's usually because their lungs have a severe inflammation and they need oxygen support or even to be intubated.
You mentioned that the research highlighted 7 or 8 regions on the genome that are of interest, and then you and the team looked at the genes that are near those regions. How does that work? How do you as a researcher actually think about this? We use physical space almost as a metaphor, right? There's this big sort of landscape and we're looking at these 8 regions, but how does that research get done?
Most of the genome is the same for everyone, but there are some places where you can have some variation. So what we do when we do this analysis, we compare places where we can have some variation with the people who had severe COVID-19 and the general population who didn't have severe COVID-19. And then this highlights some parts of the genome that then you have to relate to what are these regions doing. And to do that, we usually use some data on how these parts of the genome can vary how much of a protein your cells produce. And then we can relate, okay, so people that can produce more of this protein have more risk of having severe COVID-19 than people that produce less of this protein. And this way we can find these proteins that at the end is what we can target with drugs.
So just to make sure I understand correctly, we look at the genomes of the sort of quote-unquote normal people, and then when we compare them with the people who've had severe COVID, there are little bits of those DNA which are consistently different in all of the people who've had severe COVID. And as you were saying, we can then say, what does this bit of DNA do? And as you say, I guess almost back to the sort of central dogma of biology around DNA encodes RNA, which makes proteins. Actually, we know what those proteins do, and they affect, let's say, inflammation of the lung or the way that the immune system responds. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. That's right. Yeah.
And so what did that tell us?
So then we found that these 2 types of genes, and the main result was that one of these genes called TYK2, which is a mediator of the inflammation in your lungs, we found that high levels of TYK2 are associated with a higher probability of having severe COVID-19. And then the important part is that TYK2 can be targeted by a drug that already exists, and it has been approved, and it's used for to treat rheumatoid arthritis. And then we don't have to create a new drug. So this drug already exists. We just have to repurpose it for COVID-19. And clinical trials have started. And I think there are some indications that this treatment can be good for to treat severe COVID-19.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary ability these days, I guess, to get rapidly from this thing is happening in the DNA. We understand that function in the body. And actually, we can repurpose an existing drug to therefore treat people with that condition. That's great. And are there any other findings that would be useful to highlight?
Well, there were a couple more genes. Another one called CCR2. It's also like high levels of CCR2 were related to more severe COVID-19. High levels of the CCR2 ligand were found in autopsies of lungs of people with a severe COVID-19, so this can also be interesting. And then the other genes were related to the host antiviral response. And probably if you need a treatment for this, you would need to treat them at the beginning. That's when your body is like faced with the virus rather than when they are in ICU.
So the paper that came out was a collaboration between Erola, your team at the University of Edinburgh, and Genomics England, which is obviously a sort of a government-owned company. It would be great to understand how has that collaboration happened, and in the context of the analysis that Erola has outlined. Dorota, maybe tell us a bit more about how Genomics England played a role in contributing to that research, which Erola has just explained.
So because Genomics England holds the 100,000 genomes project participants dataset, we could use this as a proxy for the general population healthy controls, even though the participants in 100K were not recruited because of the COVID. In this situation, we could use this data and assume and treat them as a kind of general population.
How does that help to validate? So Erola was talking about looking at the specific regions on the genome for the people who had had COVID badly enough to be hospitalized and to be in intensive care because they've had it so badly. Why can't we just look at those people? Why do we need to look at the wider population?
Because basically we want to make sure that whatever we see in the sick individuals is not only by chance happening. It's, you know, when you compare in the large numbers of healthy individuals, and as you can see a statistically significant differences between the individuals with COVID-19, then you gain confidence that actually what you observe is there's actually a genetic background to the disease.
Got it. So in fact, we're recording this during the half term in June in 2021, and my 12-year-olds are revising for their summer exams, and they're learning all about control variables, dependent variables, and independent variables in their science class about things like if you have a bunch of plants and you want to understand how watering the plants affects their growth, you keep everything else constant, and you just change how much water the different plants get, but they all get the same amount of light, they all get in the same soil and so on. So I guess there's a point a bit like this, that we need those control factors to understand what's different when we change the single factor, which is being really, really, really sick with COVID. And Susie, it would be great to understand, how does whole genome sequencing play a role here, and what additional information do we hope to gain from whole genome sequencing than we would understand from just looking at subregions of the genome?
So the technology that we used in the Nature paper that was published at the end of last year it enabled us to make rapid testing of the genome and make rapid discoveries. However, it does only assay certain areas of the genome, and only certain positions and certain sites in the genome are tested, which puts limitations on the depth of the analysis that we can do. But by doing whole genome sequencing, we're able to read almost every site, every base pair in the genome. And that allows us to do not only a more fine-grained analysis of regions in a similar way to we did in the previous paper, but also look at other types of genetic variation that couldn't be captured by the technology that was used in the earlier work.
Got it. So at the risk of using another dodgy analogy, I was in John Lewis recently and was very excited just to be in a shop, because it was the first time for about a year and a bit that I'd been in a shop. And they had all of these incredible 8K TVs, which are sort of enormous high definition TVs kind of on display. Is there an analogy here around the rapid work that we did in the autumn allowed us to get the kind of the general picture of what was going on, but actually the whole genome sequencing is going to give us that sort of higher definition, crisper set of images that we can kind of zoom into to really understand what's happening at a tiny level? Does that work, or am I?
That does work, and you can almost extend it even further and say that the whole genome sequencing will give you not only higher definition in 2D but also a 3D image of the genome as well. It will let you see things, different types of things that you couldn't even see with the first technology, not only a better view of the things that you could see before.
That is great, a whole new dimension. And so we're now a few months on from the publication of the first Nature paper. What's been happening since then?
So since the paper was published, we've continued to recruit more participants to the study, and we've now got more than 12,000 participants recruited. And in fact, more than 10,000 genomes have been sequenced now to contribute to the work. And in the first study, we were using, as Erola and Dorota said, we were using population controls to compare against the severe COVID. But now we're also recruiting participants that have had a mild reaction to COVID so that we can do a specific comparison between people that have ended up in intensive care and those that have had a more mild reaction.
And so that's a lot of data, right? How much data is a single whole genome these days? Anyone?
It depends what sort of format you would be looking. So there can be formats that could be like more sparse and other formats that could be more descriptive, let's say. And I would say that the genome could be up to 100 gigabytes, if that sort of makes sense. And right now, as Susie was saying, we have not just the severe cases that we're recruiting, and we have the full genome genomic data from those. We have also the mild and also the 100K, because to increase the statistical power, we use, as Dorota said, as controls, the 100K as well. This means that we have like massive amounts of data going into the hundreds of terabytes. And if you include also the analytics, we can reach like several petabytes of data.
Wow. So my much beloved iPad Pro has, I think, 128 gig of memory, which seems an almost infinite amount. I never seem to run out of space to store films or anything else. And so we're saying roughly for each whole genome, we're talking about an iPad Pro's worth of storage. So I now have a kind of mental image of 10, 20, 30,000 iPad Pros all strung together in a warehouse somewhere. And that's just the base data, right? So how on earth do we actually analyze those data sets? You know, if I think about back in the day when I was working a lot in Excel, but let's say maybe 20 years ago, you know, if you had too many rows in Excel, the whole computer would kind of gronk and kind of grind and complain and eventually break down and you'd lose your work. How on earth do we handle working on data of that kind of size?
Well, it's not just the size, it's also the, as you're saying, that the amount of data. So we're talking about half a billion variants. So it's half a billion variations among the individuals that we study. So these massive amounts of data requires a lot of computing power as well. So apart from having a lot of storage disks, we need also a lot of what we call CPUs and a lot of memory, RAM, to load this information. And what we have built is a scalable infrastructure, which is based on the cloud, as we call it right now, and it uses the services from Amazon. And this infrastructure can actually summon, theoretically, unlimited computational resources on demand. And this can enable the analysis of these massive data sets that we are talking about. So for this project, because it was actually conceived and quickly because of the urgency of the pandemic, we needed to have like this on-demand possibility of summoning resources. And the cloud that we have is actually providing these resources.
That's incredible. So we're able to host the data and kind of crunch it with all of these resources from Amazon Web Services. You mentioned the analytical work that's going on. We have that partnership with British startup LifeBit for the environment. I wonder if it's also worth thinking about how are we enabling other groups to also gain access to and research this data as well. Dorota, I wonder, with your new hat on, so to speak, tell us a little bit about how we can then make that available to other either academic or biotech or pharma researchers as well.
So this environment allows other collaborators to come in, gain their own secure workplace where they can collaborate with others as well. And the COVID data that we hold at the moment is available there. So they can use this COVID data set to do the research they would like to do. And it's both for academics and for pharma.
Very cool. It's one of a number of extraordinary things that have happened over the last year of the pandemic. And people have talked a lot about having almost a sort of pandemic mindset about running really hard and fast against these big problems, collaborating across the whole ecosystem. As we look to the future, what do we think are the things that we can build on this? Maybe, Erola, what's next for the genomic study and where does it go from here?
So genomic was not thought as a COVID-19 project. It was thought just like much before the pandemics. So it's about studying the genetics of critical care and people in ICU. So basically, we can take what we've learned from the pandemics and just to study other diseases rather than COVID-19. And I would like also, because I forgot to say, to thank all the researchers that helped to recruit the data, the doctors and nurses, and also all the patients and the families who contributed to genomic when they were in their worst time. So.
Absolutely. No, that was that's a really, really important point. And Susie, what do you see as we look to the future?
Well, currently we are continuing to recruit participants and increase the size of our data set, and this will enable us to make more and more discoveries. The more and more people we have, the more power we will have to detect new things. And also we will be able to expand to include all the new variant types that we're able to detect from the whole genome sequencing and incorporate those into our analysis. And that will be something we expand into going forward. And in addition, we're looking at other factors that have emerged during the pandemic that we need to consider. So, for example, people that are suffering with long COVID. Initially, we were looking into severe COVID, but obviously there are people who have had a mild disease, but also have long lingering symptoms. And we want to try and understand the basis of that as well.
One of the weirdest conversations I've had through the pandemic is, in fact, a colleague of ours at Genomics England, who is South Asian by background, has grown up eating curry, so if not every day, then certainly a lot through the course of her whole life. Suddenly, after she had COVID, couldn't stand the smell or taste of coriander. And I know that if you do something like 23andMe or whatever, you know, do you like coriander or not, is one of those things that pops up on as having a sort of genetic basis. It feels like there are still so many things that we don't understand about how changes in our DNA can affect those kinds of changes in our life. I guess it might seem like a trivial example, do you like coriander or not? But is that the kind of thing that we're hoping to explain through the long COVID work?
Perhaps not exactly why someone suddenly stops liking coriander, although my dad suddenly stopped putting sugar in his tea in a similar sort of way. But it's more a similar analysis to what we've done with the severe COVID. Is there a genetic component that explains why some people have this long COVID? And if we understand the genetic basis of long COVID, can we help to develop treatments or drugs that might help?
Absolutely. So important. And Athanasios, as we think, we talked a little bit about how this can enable other researchers. How can these kinds of data and technology help with academic research that researchers in universities are doing into these kinds of topics?
As we discussed before, what we do is that all of the data that we produced as part of this project, including the analysis, we're making them available in the cloud. And this enables quite an efficient sharing of this data with other researchers once the project that they submit is approved, and also enables them as well to use these resources to do this large-scale analysis we talked about. So it's a bit of democratizing the analysis in a secure environment, protecting also the privacy of the data of the patients, because the data cannot be taken out, for example, and this is ensured by our secure environment.
Yeah, absolutely essential, isn't it? That getting that balance between the ability to do the research on the data, but while protecting the security and kind of privacy of the patients and participants who've made all of the research possible. And Dorota, how does that play out in the sort of biotech and pharma world? What kinds of questions are the industry researchers looking at?
So it's going to be in similar way what Thanos mentioned for the academics, but in from pharma perspective, it's going to be mainly looking for possible new drug targets, which could be new drugs could be developed for and then help treating the COVID, or not even treating, but helping out with people recovering from it.
That's great. And it's incredibly inspiring, not that long into this research, to see how much its impact it's already had. And we'll look forward to seeing what the next waves of the research bring. We might have to get this group back together again in 6 months to see how we're getting on. But in the meantime, thank you so much, everyone, for joining the conversation today and helping to demystify a bit, I guess, how this research work actually happens in the background. And of course, just wanted to thank again all of the patients and participants who have made this research possible, and especially at incredibly trying times for them and their family through the last year. It really is an incredible contribution that all of those families have made. So I want to say thank you again for that.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.